Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of ProJock. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I created the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you the most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is, it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you gotta check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying or selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rate. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship your reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit thereptilereport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit shipreptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile related.
Episode of Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by MoreliaPythons.com, the forum of all forums. So go check it out. And that is where currently our calendar contest is going on. And you can go over there and submit your photos for the contest. Should be pretty cool because we added a category this year, miscellaneous Python. Is there any such thing as a miscellaneous Python, Owen? What do you think?
In our case, when it comes to a non-Morelia, so it'd be a non-Morelia Python. So, like Retix or Liasis or Blood Pythons or other Python, I don't know. And pick a damn Python and throw it in there. You know, show me something cool. And, of course, we ask that the pictures be taken, you know, not with a cell phone, use a damn camera. And,
no tub pics.
Nope, tub pics. We don't want to see newspaper. Take the damn thing outside, put it on a nice little photo tent. Actually try. I mean, It's all we ask any of you guys. So definitely go over there onto the forums. If you're not a member of the forums, sign up, submit your pictures. You kind of don't want to miss this because it's a good way to kind of get your animals out there. And it's a little pat on the back to be like, you know, your carpet python is the month of, like, April. And everywhere we send these calendars, everybody's going to be looking at your python. And, of course, that's how we kind of got hooked on a few things, you know. Like, right now I'm staring at a stonewashed brettle, and, you know, my baby brettle to hatch this month. And it's like, God damn it, it's like brettle month for me over here. So it's...
Yeah.
And it is what it is. I mean, every year there's something always on there that's just absolutely stunning. If I don't get diamonds by next year, I'm going to kill myself because there's always that reduced pattern or diamond or a really pretty diamond on there. So, you know, it's fun. I mean, now we got that other category. So maybe by staring at a white lip for a month, everybody will be calling me for baby white lips.
Yeah. So, yeah, we added that only because it figures we figured that a lot of the people that keep Morelia or carpet pythons, they have one of those, you know, those miscellaneous species that they work with. Tonight we're going to be talking to Chad Brown from the Reptile Report about breeding Boland's pythons. Now, I know that those guys over there, when they were breeding pythons and stuff, they were trying for quite a while. I'd be curious to hear, and I guess we're going to hear in a couple minutes, you know, where he felt that he was going right and where he felt he was going wrong. But, you know, they worked with them for quite a while. So, yeah, real quick, though, before we bring him on, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understands the way it worked. Go over to mp.com. There's a thread there that says 2015 Morelia Python Radio Calendar Contest. All the prizes and everything are over there. You can put up your picture, and you got until when does it close? I want to say it closes on September 13th. So get your pictures up there and get it ready. And then Andrew will be coming on the show on the 16th, and that's when we're going to be judging.
That is something else you guys are also fighting for, is that if you win this, you can also you get to come on with us next year and judge the new calendar competition. So it's always cool to have that. And I swear what we're going to start doing is this week, if we see a really cool Morelia that you posted up on the Morelia Pick of the Week, and it is not posted up over there, we're just going to start screaming at you and just bombarding you on the Pick of the Week with, you know, why isn't this animal entered in the competition? So
yeah.
You've all been warned.
Yeah. So, yeah, make sure you just put what category you're putting it under. I know it probably is obvious to us, but, you know, just make sure that you put that info. So, yeah, we have Mike Curtin. He's going to be coming along later on about 9:30-ish to talk. But let's stop yapping our mouths and let's get Chad on here and talk some Boland's pythons.
No, let's stop talking. Yeah.
Hey, Chad. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. How you guys doing?
Good.
We're doing okay.
So we're going to talk about some Boland's pythons. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a history with your working with the species, and then, you know, give us your thoughts on breeding them.
Okay, gosh, my Boland's experience goes back quite a long time, probably over 20-plus years. I got my first Boland's, what we think was a male, from Bushmaster Reptiles. It was a male that someone had hacked the tail off close enough to the vent to where we couldn't tell whether it was a male or a female, but we assumed from the body structure and everything else it was a male. I'm not exactly sure why the importer sent it over to Cameron, such a, you know, I guess a useless snake from a breeding perspective. But from my perspective, you know, it was a cheaper, very cheap way for me to get some experience working with Boland's. And so that started it off, and it kind of started the passion for one day I want to be able to reproduce these guys. Fast forward a couple years after that, after growing up, this hack-tailed Bolens up for a couple of years. Cameron actually sent out a price list while I was gone on vacation in Mexico, and he had what I thought was the first captive-hatched Bolens available. So I ended up buying six baby Bolens. It was 4.2. Robin actually communicated with me in Mexico, and I can't exactly remember how he got. Hello, you guys still there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, sorry about that. I heard a little something weird on the line. Maybe he, you know, sent a telegram or something, because this was before cell phones, but I can't remember exactly how he got to me. While I was on vacation, he let me know Cameron had these animals available. I wired the money. I was the proud owner of, you know, six awesome, you know, still red baby Bolens.
Wow.
Yeah, awesome. Beautiful, beautiful animals. And, you know, because of my previous experience with that hacked tailed Bolens, you know, we had some confidence that we would be able to do pretty well, you know, particularly considering they were captive hatched. You know, before that, Bolens were just kind of noted to be very poor captives. And
right.
With some of the wild-caught stock, there was, you know, also the kind of sudden death thing where it's doing great, it's feeding, you know, you come in one day and it's turned over dead. So I was always wary of wild-caught Bolens because they were still very, very expensive.
Mm.
And I didn't consider myself at that point to be an experienced enough keeper, much less a breeder, to try to work with, you know, wild-caught animals and deworm them and all that kind of stuff. And I was still a little frightened about all the horror stories about people's, you know, $5,000 python that fed yesterday is now dead today. So I paid a pretty penny for those captive hatch Bolens from Bushmaster Reptiles. And in having that hack-tailed animal, we realized that it's really just another python. Does it have some arboreal tendencies? Does it have some slightly different temperature, you know, things that it likes? Yeah, but outside of that, it fits, you know, the basic, you know, template of python husbandry. Appropriate size meals, and, you know, great place to hide, some type of choice in temperature, you know, some type of choice in humidity. But outside of that, they were really just standard pythons. Where the Bolens, you know, seem to differ is in trying to breed them. So raising up those babies, getting them to size, getting them to breeding size, that wasn't an issue at all. That just, you know, it took a little time. I didn't want to power feed them and get them to size too quickly. So I think it's probably 3 or 4 years before we got them to the point where we felt comfortable putting them together and they had enough size. Now, we did try, before I get to the actual breeding of the animals, we did try a number of different feeding regimens because anyone who's ever kept Bolens, of all the python species that I've worked with, they perhaps have the fastest, maybe not fastest, but quickest metabolism. You can feed them a really good-sized meal, and it's gone within a day or two. You know, anybody who's fed a ball python, a jumbo rat, you know, that makes a pretty substantial bulge for quite a while. Bolens, you can feed a large rabbit, and they seem to be able to, you know, liquefy that thing within a couple of days and they're looking for more. So we had some that we raised, you know, and tried rabbits with, less rabbits but less frequently. We had some where we did, you know, the largest rats we could, and we had some where we just did, you know, more so medium-sized to large rats. But, you know, five or six at a time and a couple of times a week. And regardless of what the feeding regimen was, it really didn't seem to change the growth of the animals, nor did it seem to really change, you know, the ability for them to kind of power through whatever we put into them. I'll get to the caging here now. So because we, you know, looked into the wild habitat of the species, realizing they're pretty mountainous species, so because they are black and, you know, they can be able to find some rocky outcropping in the hills of Papua New Guinea, you know, they can get access to some really high, you know, temperatures. Not necessarily high ambient temperatures, so the ambient temperatures don't have to be very high, but they do have access as a black snake lying on top of a rock to, you know, anyone who's used a temp gun outside on a 70-degree day, but on top of their blacktop recognizes ambient temperature and actual, say, basking temperatures can be quite different. So we focused on giving the animal as many choices as possible. So we did a series of vision cages, 2 6-foot visions on the bottom, 2 6-foot visions in the middle, and 2 6-foot visions on the top. And all these cages were connected. And we had, you know, we kind of built doors into these where in those 6 cages would essentially be a pair of bolens, 1 male and 1 female. We could separate them for feeding. But in this setup we did, we thought we would be able to give them an incredible access to different temperatures and different humidities. So on the very bottom cages, those were on the cement floors in our Colorado warehouses. So they were, you know, about as cold as a temperature as we could get outside of putting those animals outside, depending on the time of the year. There was no heat at all in those bottom cages. And we typically did a cypress mulch down there and kept it pretty moist. So not only was it moist, but it was pretty cool down there. On that second row of vision cages, we had a couple of strips of heat tape running underneath those. So they were able to, you know, lie on top of that heat tape, and the heat tape was probably running about 105 degrees, which was pretty hot. But again, you know, considering these animals and how they use their wild habitats and for what we were able to gather, we wanted to give them access to not only cool, but some pretty high temperatures as well. And then on that very top level, we used those shrouds that are in those larger vision cages and put a large, you know, a 45-watt halogen bulb in there and then put, you know, some of those black Rubbermaid trash can lids right underneath that bowl. So whether the snakes got underneath that trash can lid, it was about 105 degrees, or they got on top of the trash can lid, where it was about 130 degrees, they had access to fantastic temperature variance. Whatever they wanted, they pretty much had access to it. It was quite interesting to see them, you know, use the cage at different times of the year and how the sexes would differ in their cage use as well. Now, we didn't come up with this idea all on our own, as much as I want to take credit for that. Right. We went in and visited Stan Chiris here in Colorado. So Stan had been, you know, his dream was just like ours to breed bolens, not just on a, you know, 1 or 2 time as had kind of had been done previous, but on a consistent basis. Stan was here in Colorado before he moved to Tennessee, and he had a large cage in his basement, but these animals had actually, he opened a door through the cinder block, and they had access to the outside as well. So he would give them, he would open this door up, and his caging was a little bit more elaborate than ours. He also wanted to test the So he had this large black piece of iron that he put into the cage. But beneath this piece of iron, he put a pressure switch. So whenever the bolens got on this piece of iron, it activated a large red bulb right above this piece of iron. So they quickly learned. So apparently it turns out they are intelligent. When they got on top of this piece of iron, it would kick this heat source on. And so his animals would bask on that large piece of iron underneath that red light. But again, they also had access to the outside Colorado weather. So that's where we kind of got our idea from. We didn't, he did this at his home. We didn't feel comfortable punching holes in our rental warehouse walls, so we didn't do that. We didn't take it too far. I'm sure our landlord would have been too happy about that. But so, you know, we recognized that they needed access to heat, but they also needed access to cool because the mountains of New Guinea are not necessarily a real true tropical environment. At nighttime, it can get really cool up there, and there are stretches in the winter, particularly on the higher mountains, where they won't see days over 50 degrees unless the sun breaks through for weeks at a time. So that was kind of our goal with the Cajun was to provide as much variance as we could within our warehouse situation. Yeah, so, you know, again, trying to, you know, give the animals what they need. And this was a long-standing thought between Robin and I, whether we were working with ball pythons or monitor lizards or Asian rat snakes, is try to give them as much choice as possible within the cage and then begin to learn what they use and then begin to, you know, hack away at the unessentials, but leaving them the essentials so they can do what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
What in all the what did you what were some of your observations as far as like take the females, like did they use the heat, did they go to the bottom, did you see them, you know, what was what temperatures did they, you know, look for, did it change from season?
In the winter they typically like to hang out on the bottom cage, so anybody who's, you know, familiar with ball pythons has seen a ball python female curled around her water bowl trying to gather some cool. So they definitely do the normal python behaviors of in the winter the females are trying to gather cool so they can grow their follicles. But you know, a water bowl in a 78-degree cage is not going to be enough cool for a bowline female. She wants to get down and kind of nuzzle into that cool cypress mulch at the bottom, trying to get as cool as possible. The male was not nearly as cool-seeking as the females. Now, we had a couple sets of these cages, and we had a couple pair of bowlings set up this way. Now, before we moved, this was in our last warehouse. Before we were in this warehouse, we actually had them set up in our more typical python room, but in the winter, we would move them into our hibernation room with our Gila monsters and our colubrids. We would give them access to a light source or a heat source for about 8 to 10 hours a day, most days of the winter, and they would come up and heat up on that, and then once the lights went off, they were subjected to the Colorado winters, and the heat in that room would kick on if it got below 42 degrees. But most nights it was in that 45 to 55 degree range most of the nights in the Colorado winters. And in all this cool offering to these, you know, what people think of as tropical pythons, we never experienced any respiratory or anything like that. So they're not nearly as sensitive as, say, a blood python or, you know, some other species of python, which can be, you know, pretty respiratory sensitive. These guys are pretty bulletproof. I know the wild-caught ones had that reputation before, but as far as captive hatch bowlings, even captive hatch over there in Indonesia, we found them to be, you know, incredibly hardy, tough animals, and the temperatures didn't seem to give them any issues at all. Even digesting food in cool temperatures didn't seem to cause them any issues at all. So in the morning, typically the females, to get back to your question, would be basking right on top of those Rubbermaid trash can lids at the very top, about 130 degrees. After an hour or so of that, you know, they were bigger pythons, 10 to 12 feet plus by this age. So it would take a while for them to heat up. They just couldn't bask for a few minutes and get all that mass warm. They would bask for about an hour or so. Then they would get underneath the trash can lid and hang out there for a couple of hours. And then by the afternoon, they typically were down in the bottom level of the cage trying to seek cool. The least used part of the cage was that medium level of cages where the heat tape was. They either wanted to be hot or they wanted to be cool. They never really hung out in that middle level. So if I were to, you know, do bowlings again, I would just do two stacks of cages. I would eliminate that middle level because, again, it just was kind of unnecessary space. And it was very rarely used. So, you know, if anybody's trying to design a cage, you don't need that mid-range. You need kind of, you need cool, you need warm, you need a spot for them to kind of hang out in between, but you don't need a large area for them to just kind of be room temperature. So that was the caging setup. But regardless of the caging setup, whether they were in our more typical python room at our previous warehouse or in our stacked vision cages at our last warehouse, the breeding behavior was almost always exactly the same for us. The males would court them for a couple of weeks.
Right.
We would see copulation, and copulation was typically more in the late winter, not necessarily a spring breeder, but a late winter breeder. The females would grow follicles. We were able to track the follicles on the ultrasounds. Once we saw follicle growth, it was rare we saw copulation after that. Maybe I would even go beyond rare. I don't think I saw copulation after the females were maybe 15 to 18 millimeters in size. Once that initial follicular growth happened, the males seemed to show very little interest at that point. So that was our experience in our collection. Although we would keep them paired up and they would lay together, you know, no courting behavior and no copulation. The female follicles would continue to grow, and they would get to a size where we would think, oh, wow, okay, she's probably going to be ovulating soon, you know, based on our experience with ultrasounds, yeah, with ball pythons and blood pythons and, you know, other pythons that we had ultrasounded in the past. And then the females never ovulated in our collection. Never, not one time. So, I mean, a decade plus of this same pattern over and over and over without actual ovulation. And, you know, you start thinking, well, maybe I'm doing something wrong. Maybe they need something different. Let's buy, you know, a whole freezer full of guinea pigs. Let's try to feed them all guinea pigs. You know, 1 year we did all rabbits. You know, so you keep trying to do something different, and we were never able to, you know, get the females to ovulate. Now, at the time, I don't think, particularly when the animals were younger, I had a complete grasp of the reproductive process and how important it is to keep the female cool until she ovulates. So I think, you know, we naturally, you know, your warehouse or your house temperature is going to start getting warmer as the spring progresses. So that was right along the same time that the female Bolin's follicles were really getting close to ovulation. So I think it was ended up being our fault that we did not, or we could not, in some instances, continue to give them access to cool enough temperatures to allow ovulation to happen. They started heating up, the follicles would shrink, the females would shrink those follicles back down. Now I think I recognize what the issue was. So I would do something different, move them maybe into my basement here at my house, because obviously I had, you know, 1,000-plus ball pythons and all these Asian rat snakes and other animals I had to warm up so they could do their thing. So I couldn't, you know, hold back the rest of the collection so I could try to produce a couple of, you know, Bolin females. So, you know, I think I know how I would attack it. Now, I had 95% of the formula down. I just think another month or two of access to really cool temperatures would have been the trick. But again, because of our setups, because of the other animals that were sharing the spaces, it was really impossible for us to do that as we were set up before.
I have a couple questions. We've talked to people who've bred Bolins and on the show, and it seems as of late that there seems to be more of a steady flow, I guess, of people being successful. Do you think that the female being just in captivity and feeling secure and whatnot? I guess if you're trying the same thing over and over again for 10 years, I guess I think that she would be secure by that point. So that kind of like blows my theory out of the water there. do you think that has anything to do with it? Like them just feeling secure enough to go the distance and ovulate?
I think so. And I think so. And it's a fascinating thing that you know, whether those animals were reproduced over in Indonesia at some farm, or a gravid female was shipped over and the animals hatched here in the U.S., I just think a couple of generations in captivity seems to remove a lot of these triggers for breeding, for ovulation, that the wild animals absolutely needed. You know, there was, when we first started working with our ball pythons, and, you know, some of our older, bigger adults were wild-caught animals, they were, you know, we considered ball pythons fairly difficult to work with and to breed. But after we, you know, had a couple of generations in into captivity, and we were able to breed essentially ball pythons all year round. We were able to almost remove the seasonality of it. Now, of course, you know, most of the animals went within the regular season of when you think ball pythons reproduce. But
right.
Towards the end, before we had our fire, we were getting eggs every month of the year and hatching eggs every month of the year. Our incubator was never empty. At no point was it ever empty. It was always ball pythons cooking and always ball pythons hatching. I think as a breeder, you begin to recognize the cues that the animals are giving off. But also the animals, I think, they begin to not need as strong of triggers as maybe they would have just a couple of generations ago. So, say, at some reptile farm over in Indonesia, maybe they have bred a couple of generations of Bolan's pythons. So now those founder animals that the people in the U.S. have been having success with the last couple of years, they may be a couple of generations removed from the wild, and therefore need less triggers to make it all happen. So I think it's just, you know, a product of captivity that it becomes easier and easier to breed these animals, number one, as we become better breeders and recognize
right.
the animals and what they're trying to tell us, but also the animals less, you know, external stimulus to start the reproductive process, or in the case of Bolan's, to actually finish the reproductive process.
Right. With that being said, here's a question that we got in from Buddy. His question is, can you ask Chad, right now it takes about 5 to 7 years to acclimate Bolan's for breeding. Does he think that that will change as more captive bred animals are made available, or are they just a python that takes a long time to breed?
I think they are a, you know, a slower species to mature, but again, I think that, you know, 5 to 7 years will probably become, you know, 4 to 6 years with these most recent breedings. Maybe those animals will reproduce sooner. This last, you know, last year's hatch, and then a couple years down the road, it may be, you know, 3 to 5 years. I mean, you know, it's to the point now where, at least in the ball python game, where if you got a 6-month-old male, there's a strong chance you can breed him to one or two females, and you know, 10 years ago. So again, as the animals are bred and we begin to, you know, stretch the limits of the animals, you know, these rules that we consider to be rules, I think will begin to, you know, be a lot looser as far, you know, whether it's, you know, the seasons in which the animals breed, how long they can breed, or how early they can breed, or how many females a male can, you know, get to reproduce with. All those things are kind of being stretched as these animals are, you know, further and further into captivity. You know, my first year of breeding ball pythons, I kept my males in there forever with the females. You know, my
right.
last couple of years, because I was so in tune with the process, I could get a male to copulate and have enough viable sperm to get, you know, 10 females to, you know, go with that single male, because I limited his exposure to the females because I put him in exactly the right time. So I think Bolan's will become easier to breed. The time frame will become shorter as we get, you know, better with it. When I start green tree monitors, something
right,
we
yeah.
worked with pretty extensively after our fire, because they were in a separate warehouse. It took me 10 years to get viable eggs.
Wow. That's dedication.
Right. The next generation, those viable eggs, I was able to get those animals to produce eggs and get those eggs to hatch when those animals were about 16 months old. When those eggs hatched, I was able to get eggs and have those eggs hatch from that next generation in 13 and 14 months. So I would have been a year to year probably within the next generation. So you can begin to understand how to raise the animals up properly, what they need to grow properly, what they need to reproduce, how quickly can they reproduce, you know, as you learn the animal. So the sample size for Bolin's reproduction, the sample size of number of animals in collections, is just really so small. So Bolin's breeding is really at its infancy. There was a hit-or-miss clutch, you know, every couple years for the last 10 or 12 years. But now there seems to be some folks who are having some, you know, smaller but repeated success. So five years from now, this will be a steady thing, and Bolin's, captive hatch Bolin's, will be on the market at reasonable prices, and people will be reproducing them at consistent levels and consistent rates. It just takes time to, you know, first you crack the code, but then you realize as time goes on, there's other pieces of the code that I didn't realize. Then you begin to crack those pieces as well. Then you start to develop a set recipe, which is, you know, now where, say, ball pythons are or corn snakes are. There's a very set and clear recipe, a clear understanding of the reproductive process, and we're just now beginning to get that to that point with Bolin's.
Man, I can't wait for that day when you can just get a captive born and bred Bolin's python, you know? Yeah. Wow.
They are, as far as my pythons, Bolin's are by far my favorite species of python. When they're beautiful babies, when they're red, I like when they grow up in all the black. I love the iridescence. I love the velvetiness. Working with captive Bolin's, they're about as deliberate and about as calm a species of python that I've worked with. I could even describe them as kind of being curious. They're not trying to run away and hide from you. They're curious about you. They're curious about their surroundings. I think their size gives them it's hard to call a python confident, but it gives them a confidence as they move around, as they, you know, kind of investigate their surroundings. So, you know, I look forward to lots of keepers being able to work with Bolin's over the next, you know, 10 years as they become reproduced consistently, because it is such a awesome species of python. As far as a pet species of python, I would recommend Bolin's over anything because of their beauty, because of their deliberate nature, and because they're easy to handle and to work with.
Right.
That's awesome.
Wow. Yeah. They're on my list for next year. Definitely I have to experience this. I've seen one for the first time in person at ICAST. And, man, I was there, just amazing animals.
Yeah.
Awesome stuff.
Yeah, I mean, amazing, majestic. You can put all the words you want to it, and you still put one in your hand for the first time, and you're like, oh, my goodness. This exceeds all my expectations. It's even more awesome than I thought it would be.
Right. So true.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Well, I guess I should ask this question. Do you ever see yourself getting another pair to mess around with, to try, you know, to try things out? I know you guys have moved away from the whole captive breeding stuff, but.
Yes. Yes, as you know, I went on a reptile tour of Southern California, so to speak, with Brian from Snake Bites, from Brian from BBA Reptiles. And, you know, whether I was at Jay Brewer's place, Prehistoric Pets, and handling his big giant retics, or to go to Triple L Reptiles into their breeding facility, and, you know, being in a whole room of really awesome Lucianus, I have to say, I've been bitten by the reptile bug again. As much as I wanted to be animal-free for a while, just to kind of, you know, give myself a break, you know, I find myself looking at cage websites, trying to think, okay, they'll be small for a couple of years so I can get by with this cage. You know, so I'm already starting to get down that road again. And if I were to work with this species, it would probably be bolens. And unfortunately for me, I have a hard time picking up on the cues that the animals are giving if I just have a pair. So I would want to get at least 3 or 4 pair just so the signals the animals are sending would be that much more clear to me. I wouldn't keep 4 pair forever. I probably would end up, you know, paring it down to a pair or two after a while. But that would enable me to look at the animals, you know, see which animals, how they're using their cages, how I'm doing as a keeper, get all those clues that the animals send you. Because if you start to see patterns with 4 females and 4 males as opposed to just 1 male and 1 female, you can see the pattern. You can see this is a consistent set of behavior. So having multiple pairs of the animals will allow you to do that. That's how I would start. I would raise them up for, you know, 4 or 5 years and then probably keep back the best 2 pair, sell the others off, and really begin to try to work with them and breed them on a consistent basis.
All right.
Excellent.
Well,
excellent.
Wish you luck with that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you, once I find a spare $20,000 to pick up, you know, 4 pair of bolts, then I can start the process.
Yeah.
It's good to know that I'm not the only one with this reptile addiction.
No. And it's a slippery slope. You know, like what Chad, you were saying, like you're looking at cages. And you're like, I can just get this rack. And then you're going to get this rack. You're like, oh, my gosh, I have extra tubs. And then it's over. After that, the whole room, you got cages all over, and it's done. So, excellent.
Yeah, you know, because I'm thinking, okay, well, if I actually do breed them, then I need a rack for babies.
For the babies,
Then I need a grow-out rack. Then I need some grow-up cages. So now I've got, you know, 4 sets of cages, and now I'm filling up tubs. And now I need a freezer for all my frozen rodents, you know. So
yep, it's a slippery slope.
So I've been trying to avoid that, and so far, you know, that fire was in September of 2011, and, you know, we'll be in September of 2014 here soon, so I've fought the good fight, but I don't know how much longer I can fight the fight.
Not easy, man.
I wouldn't have lasted this long.
And then, you know, to keep it a little bit, you know, I know this is Morelia Radio, and bolens are, you know, part of the Morelia family. But some of the work that the carpet python people are doing and the look of some of those animals, I mean, come on. They are just absolutely mind-blowing. So, you know, if I do have some bolens, well, maybe I should raise up a couple of carpets because they're in the same family, and maybe it'll help me understand bolens better, you know?
This logic works for me. I like it. I love it. So,
It's reptile logic. It doesn't work in any
other
part
logic.
Of life.
It's great logic. Fantastic.
It only works in the reptile world.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, man. All right, Chad. Well, thanks for the insight in the bolens breeding and whatnot. And you know, hopefully in a couple years, everybody will be able to keep such a cool python. You know, and they'll be ready available, and people can enjoy them. So
yeah. So if anybody's listening who's going to, you know, take it up, just let me know when you have those animals in a couple years, and I'll buy them from you.
Done.
All right,
Chad. Thanks a lot.
All right, great. I'll talk to you guys soon. Thanks.
All right. See ya.
Bye-bye.
All right. I guess we shouldn't waste any time. Let's get Mike on.
Yeah, go straight to Mike.
Hey, Mike.
What's going on, fellas?
Nothing much. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. Listening to Chad talking about, you know, patterns, and I'm listening to the three of you plus me and patterns going as far as hatchling tubs to grow out tubs to grow up cages. Man, there's some patterns going on there, too.
Yeah.
It's not just him. It's not just me. It ain't just you guys.
Yeah. No, isn't that the way you find yourself? Oh, I'm not going to do that. I find like every couple of years I say, oh, I'm going to downsize a bit. And I find that in a couple of months I'm upsizing, actually, not downsizing.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I'm at.
That's where I'm kind of at right now. You know, I had my whole collection in the master bedroom. And
mm-hmm.
you know, my wife's really incredible. So the walk-in closet was a hatchling room, and all the cages were in the rest of the master bedroom. And we were in the next bedroom down. And so we had my own bathroom as far as cleaning tubs, cleaning water bowls, you know, doing everything. And I'm like, man, I don't have time for this. So I wound up downsizing.
Yeah.
And now I'm kind of, you know, just maintaining probably half the animals that I did have. And
mm-hmm.
as I'm looking, I'm like, man, I really want to, I mean, Owen, you're an evil human being. I mean, I see you at a hamburger and you got that baby white lip.
I am. I apologize for that. Mike comes up and I hand him a baby black face white lip because I just had brought one of mine with me, and I knew he was going to be there. And Mike's one of those guys that he's like, the second you get babies, that better be like the first phone call you make. So, you know, I knew you would appreciate the animal, and also I wanted to be a little devious. So,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, come on. But I know you got time.
So I'm in the process of converting my garage, so I'll have
plenty of room.
I think the room's going to get bigger again. We'll see what I do.
You're going to be done converting the garage, and you'll be like, you know, there's room for more racks over there. So, and then it's, you know, again, the slippery slope downward, yeah. So
Sure.
So when you downsize your stuff, you know, what are you working with now? Like, I know carpet pythons, but like what projects?
The ocelots are probably forefront right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of them. The 2012 breeding between between Jigsaw and his sister Camille. That just about every single one of the babies was what I considered low to high expression ocelot. I had some really crazy babies out of that. I've got a couple of normals out of that they're non, let's put it this way, they're non-jags, and they're both females, and we'll see if any of what looks like that ocelot trend, that ocelot pattern,
right.
We'll see if it actually translates, and I can reproduce that from non-jag animals, which I think I have a pretty good shot of having that work.
Okay.
That'd be kind of cool.
Now, for the people that maybe this bothers you too, but for the people that don't know, or maybe that they are new to carpets or the morphs or whatever, what are the characteristics that say ocelot to you? When you're talking about this ocelot gene, what is it that sticks out as what makes a snake an ocelot?
What sticks out forefront to me, all right, is primarily that pixelated look. And this is, I mean, I think it's most recognizable in my line. The same thing with Paul Harris. He's got that same pixelation, that broken pattern, the striping that comes down the neck, and almost like a broken up pixelated pattern in the sides. Now there's also the color in the saddle. Now this is something that you see a lot with Bill Stiegel's animals, all right,
mm-hmm.
where if you look at, now he does have, you know, definitely some of the, a little bit of the pixelation, a little bit of the aberrancies in the pattern,
mm-hmm.
but what
he and a lot of others also identify as ocelot is when the internal saddle color matches the ground color of the animal. So normally you'll have, you know, that bright yellow jungle jag, and inside the saddle you'll have the beige, you know, you'll have the browns. And instead of that, you'll have in the ocelot animals, you have the circles with that bright yellow inside those saddles and inside those circles. So you have some spotting there.
Gotcha. Okay.
Cool.
They're cool looking snakes, that's for sure. Okay.
They're really neat.
So you've read that?
This year was the first time I bred an ocelot to something that is completely unrelated, no chance of any ocelot blood in it, okay?
Okay.
All my breedings thus far, the first ocelot that I produced was random. It was a jungle female from unknown lineage to a there was a male 50% jungle jag that I got from Jay McClear. And one of the babies was Jigsaw, and he's very, very aberrant ocelot. Now, when I first posted him up, you know, people were immediately talking about Paul Harris's ocelot. That's where, you know, that was the first time I ever bred a jag. That was my second carpet python breeding ever, which was pretty incredible. So I said, I'm like, awesome. I got all these jags, and I got, you know, and I posted some pictures on MP, and you know, somebody said, hey, what is that in the corner? It was still in the egg, you know. So I was brand new to it. I was like, holy cow, yeah. And I once it came out of the egg, it was absolutely incredible looking. Now, I bred that animal when it got to size. I bred him to his paternal aunt twice and wound up with a lot of high expression ocelots. I bred him to a female jungle that was also from Jay McClear's line, all right, which was related to the animal that produced his father. Okay, so it was still within the same gene pool. This year I bred him to a caramel that I got from Nick. And it was a pure coastal caramel. And out of those offspring, there was a super. Now, I'm sure you guys have seen pictures of it. I don't know how many people listen have seen pictures of it, but this is the most aberrant, most high expression ocelot I've ever produced, and it's a caramel on top of it. And I produced that. I produced a caramel jag that doesn't even really look like an ocelot. You might be able to pick up some traits, you know, right along the belly scales, right along the side. Some ocelot traits, and then there were two heavily banded caramels.
Right.
One ocelot jag that's a non-caramel, and one normal. So that's what I mean. It was so nicely split as far as the different, you know, the different mutations.
Right.
So I was pretty excited about that.
That's awesome.
Seeing that ocelot pattern being passed on in a more of a co-dominant fashion, I guess you would call it, because, you know, you're seeing it with an animal that's completely unrelated. There's no chance that there's any, you know, the early theory was that a very subtle mutation of the jungle carpet population in the U.S.
Right.
Because Paul's initial jungle that produced that ocelot was, I believe, a U.S. jungle. I believe, I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure.
Right.
So it was kind of neat, you know, especially this year, having downsized to a smaller room, really, and now, you know, talking about all the different triggers and what have you, I've got a bunch of animals that were used to a large room, lots of airflow, you know, good discernible triggers, good discernible cooling, and then moved everything into a smaller room. I had a very, very poor season this year. A lot of stuff just didn't go for me.
Right.
So the ocelot to caramel pairing, that was kind of an afterthought. That was a, you know, let me give this a shot. Let me see if they'll go. And they didn't. I tell you, when those eggs started hatching, the ocelot caramel was the second to last egg that I opened, and I saw that thing, and I almost fell over, and it was upside down, neck or yolk stalk wrapped around the neck, and yeah. I'm like, my heart stopped.
Oh man!
I reached in. I popped its head out, you know, and I kind of untangled a little bit. I'm like, oh. You know, I sent a picture to one person, my buddy Mike Bronya. I sent him a picture of it, and I said, check it out. And he's like, holy cow. I said, don't tell anybody. I said, I don't know if it's going to make it, because it wasn't moving.
Right.
And I put it back in the incubator, and I didn't breathe for about 12 hours, and came back to the one, and it actually wound up being the biggest one, the biggest, the most robust, and looks, I mean, it's doing great, just ate, so.
Awesome.
Jeez.
So, wow. Pretty good.
Man, I mean, I've seen, it seems like, I don't know, maybe it's just seeing new carpet python mutations, but it seems to me like the ocelot kind of like, you know, I think of your caramel jags, caramel ocelot jags, or and then the zebra jags with the ocelot in it that Bill had, and it's just like it turns it up a notch or something. Oh, my God.
Yeah, ocelot
wow.
brings something new to the table in color and pattern. I mean, it's almost it's a step above what you would expect for a normal jungle jag. And now that it's being mixed into other things, it's kind of raising the bar up a little higher. If I could steal Bill's ocelot zebra jag, I would, and like a heartbeat, just take it from him. And
well, so,
you know, he never know it was me. So.
And you know what? As far as kicking it up a notch, what I have noticed without a doubt is that the ocelots seem to be a lot brighter than some of their non-ocelot clutch mates.
Really?
They seem to be the more aberrant they are, and it could just be the eye, it could just be the contrast, but it seems to me that they are definitely more vibrant than some of the non-ocelot clutch mates, yeah.
Hmm. Wow. That's cool.
That's helpful.
Yeah, Bill just sent me a message, and he's telling me that they hold their yellow into adulthood a lot better.
That's good.
I wonder if that, do you think that's the jungle blood that's in it, or do you think that that's actually part of the gene, or the gene?
You know what? I think it's part of whatever's going on with the ocelot, you know, with that gene, because, you know, the non-ocelot or the low expression ocelots, they got the same exact amount of jungle blood, you know, so there's really no reason to, you know, that the high expression ones would hold better, you know, but I've noticed the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. You guys have inspired me this year, because I have a female ocelot jag that I got from Paul. And I'm putting
I still don't think I've seen any real good pictures of that animal.
Yeah,
I've never actually seen it. I've been over to his house. I don't think it exists. So
you haven't seen it, Owen? No?
I don't. You keep trying to show me your IJs, and you know, then I have to pretend to like it. I mean, you know,
yeah.
You keep all the good stuff hidden. So.
Well, she's going with a caramel zebra this year, so we'll see what.
There
happens.
You go. Oh, nice.
Cool, cool stuff. Well, I want to do some pictures of that one you got from Paul. You know, because I've been wanting to check her out, and that I'm sure she's nice.
Yeah, it's so different looking though. I mean, I can see such a weird head pattern on her, and it's not anything as extreme as what you or what Bill has, but you can definitely see that it has what you're talking about. But
cool.
Just such a, I don't know, so different than what I have in my collection as far as Jags go, you know. But
well, I tell you, like, and talking to Bill, you know, a lot of times, you know, over the past few years on MP.com, you know, a lot of his lower expression stuff, I didn't really consider to be quote unquote ocelot. And I think we actually discussed this on the show a few months ago when Bill was on, and he popped out that ocelot zebra jack. I mean, that blew me away. I'm like, holy cow. So even the lower expression ones, you know, they can throw some crazy babies, you know, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And if you look at, you know, the male that produced, that sired my founding ocelot, he didn't look any different than any other jungle jag.
Huh.
And
right.
Here it came, you know?
Huh. Man, I think, like, if you were to put, like, diamond blood into that, I mean, can it get any brighter? Like, wow.
And can we make it just burn your eyes? I mean, you know, how far do we want to go with this?
It might, you know, I've been kind of, sort of, and this is where it gets dangerous, because we talked about downsizing, and well, I'm going to downsize except for those diamonds that I want to plug into my ocelot project. You know, but yeah, I totally agree. You can definitely probably crank it up some more. Are either of you guys going to be at the White Plains show coming up in September?
I will attempt to make it, see what's cooking, but I was going to try to come out there. I'm usually good for about one or two White Plains a year.
Yeah.
Cool, because I'm gonna bring a nice handful of them with me, just to put on display. And I mean, I've got really, really crappy camera skills, so I seem to never really capture their true color. I put a bunch of pictures up of some of the ocelot stuff, and I didn't take any of them. Those are all Mike was over helping me clean cages, and. He's like, hey, you want me to take some pictures? I'm like, yeah, go for it, man.
Knock yourself out.
he took a couple and was like, well, get one of this too, you know?
Wow.
That is cool.
Yeah. When is White Plains?
Mike.
It's the 7th.
7th.
Yeah, September 7th, Sunday.
Yeah, and if you haven't been to Mike's table at White Plains, he is usually there. You can point out Mike Curtin in a crowd, you know, whether he's got his beard on or not. He's usually bald with a bunch of tattoos. So, you know, and just look for the bright yellow freaking snakes. It's kind of like there's this light that brings you towards Mike Curtin's table. So
it's the table that's glowing.
Yeah, there you go.
Nice.
But yeah, you can stare at all the ocelots that have all the tags that say not for sale, and then you kind of want to die a little, but
I'm sorry.
So pretty.
Yeah, then that's the other thing I guess you must be having the problem with is that whole, you know, holding back, and you know what I mean? Like, then your collection is
I've sold a few of them. You know, not many. I've sold a handful of them. Probably half a dozen have been sold. I've probably got a good at least a dozen or more, you know, good higher expression ocelot stuff. Now the first clutch of ocelots, all, you know, I kept Jigsaw and I kept his sister, one of his sisters. Mm-hmm. And all the other ones, you know, those were sold.
Right.
Yeah.
So, initially anything that was not jump out, stand out, wow, that's different.
Right.
I let go. I wound up selling because you can't keep everything.
Right.
It was only the 2012 season where it's like, you know what, I'm definitely, you know, I'm keeping all these back, and even those, I believe I sold two of them, and I traded off a Jag and I believe two normals from that pairing. So
right,
but yeah, it's hard. I mean, because you want to keep everything, and you want to say, okay, you know, I'm going to pair this with this, and this with this, and what have you, and then you look at it realistically, and you say, "Can I do 15 pairings?" And
yeah,
and what if, like, and you pray that you're not successful, you know?
Yeah.
You know, especially wife, three kids, and a full time job.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
That's
a long time.
I was talking to Nick today, and he was telling me that, you know, he's got like 600-plus babies on the ground.
Sure, yeah.
And I just can't – I mean, I know he does it full-time, but, man, I'm struggling with, like, how many clutches I have? Four? You know what I mean?
It's like – I have 95 babies right now, and I want to die. So,
yeah.
I mean, things right now.
I mean, getting them going and, you know, taking pictures and getting them up for sale and, oh, man.
Well, you see all the pictures I've been posting lately.
Right. Right.
I'm up, you know, the little ones are on me at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you know, I'm with them till I leave for work. I get home around, you know, 9-10 o'clock at night. So I have a few hours in the evening to take care of the snakes. And I mean, we go through seasons in life with everything, you know.
Sure.
I'm kind of, you know, I did put a lot of stuff together this past season, but like I said, it was just, it's actually kind of a blessing that more stuff didn't go, you know.
Right
now I've got like 50 babies, and I'm good. I'm content. I'm like, all right, I can handle 50.
Yeah.
You know.
It's kind of. I got a question for you guys. So
sure.
And since we're all here on the East Coast, we can all relate to this. Yeah. So. What do you guys think about as far as, like, we're just talking, right? So about how many pairings you're going to do and whatnot. And I heard this from somebody today, and they're not in the carpet python world, but they were saying that they were talking about the next big thing, so to speak. Like, what's the next big, you know, trend in the hobby? And they say that the people are going more towards, like, you know, I guess the rare type of species and such, but they were saying that carpet pythons are kind of like the big thing now, and blood pythons are the big thing now. So those two are kind of like, you know, not nearly as big as ball pythons. I'm not saying that, but there's more demand for them. So with that being said, do you guys, when you're doing your pairings, Are you gearing yourself more towards entry-level, you know, entry-level projects to where somebody could come along and just, say, pick up a Coastal or a Jag? I mean, because the price of the Jag has dropped down, you know, do you find you wanting to produce those animals? You know, because I ride the Chondro breeders because they're doing more of the higher-end stuff, but I guess in a way I can kind of understand it, and they're not doing, like, just basic locality because the amount of work that goes into getting those babies established and ready to go for sale is just a lot of work. And do you focus that energy on, you know, pushing the, you know, carpet python breeding projects further, or do you have something that's entry level for somebody coming in? What's your thoughts?
My thoughts on that are, I guess, kind of selfish. When I've got a clutch hatching,
right,
I want to be blown away by every baby that comes out of one of those eggs.
Okay.
I do it. I mean, that's, and everybody says, yeah, I do it. I do it for me, and it's not about the money. Blah, blah, blah. Well, I want to be blown away by everything. I want that level of excitement when I see that baby, and it's like, man, that's exactly what I was going for. You know, that's exactly what I wanted. I'm not only doing carpets, so I do have other stuff on my table.
Right.
That's more entry level. And I do have, you know, you can do the most stellar jungle pairing imaginable. And you're going to have some babies that are not so attractive.
Agreed. Right.
No matter what you do, you're always going to have those entry-level babies. So
yes,
my primary goal when I'm putting animals together is what's gonna make me jump around the house like a maniac. when I'm sure you've seen pictures of Link, all right?
Yes.
Shad Quill has him at his house right now. He was over there for breeding loan. And Link was my second ocelot that I produced. Now, it was the first time breeding Jigsaw. Didn't know if it was a fluke, if it was going to be reproducible, whatever. So it was like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Christian, my eldest, was sleeping, and I came home from fishing. I look in the incubator, and they're pipping.
Uh-huh.
So I pull my wife out of bed. I said, honey, the Jigsaw clutch is hatching. I said, you want to come open the eggs? And she said, yeah. So she comes, we're here we are like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, we're opening eggs. And I see that spotted, pixelated, classic ocelot pattern. And I was in the middle of the snake room, I'm jumping up and down, literally jumping up and down. Trying not to make noise, trying not to like yell because I'm so excited. I mean, I can still feel what that feels like, you know. So every pairing I do, it's like, man, I want to do that. That's what
you
I
want. That
do.
You want that. You want that egg, that quintessential thing that you were chasing when you put these animals together. I can relate and agree with that. Is that the whole point of my breeding is, of course, to have animals to sell. To expand on projects, to have products for the general public to purchase, but it's also for me, and it's about expanding my own collection, and if I'm going to be putting my animal together, I kind of want them to be, you know, I'm going for the best bang for my buck. I'm going to pair this female with this male. Why? Because them together is going to make fantastic babies, and I'm not going to get a whole clutch of beautiful, fantastic. But there's going to be those standalone ones, like my holdbacks. See, I'm a greedy son of a bitch, and I want really good holdbacks for myself. So, you know, I just had the Caramel Jag clutch the past year, and one Super Caramel Jaguar female that I'm keeping is just exactly what I wanted. She's perfect, and she's what I chased the entire clutch for. So, And the rest are gorgeous, but she's mine, and I'm happy because she's mine, because, well, what's the thing we always keep saying is that when once you produce the clutch, you get first dibs, so that's why it's awesome. So
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I think of, you know, albino zebra jags and sun glow jags were what I was after this year, and I was lucky enough to hit on both. But then I'm kind of like, I guess I got too lucky because I don't really have any of, like, the...
The lower end?
Yeah, you know what I mean?
So, yeah, right, yeah.
Wow, that worked out too well.
The other thing is that the lower end for, like, coastals is not really that much of a lower end. I mean, if you do coastal to coastal, you get coastals, but now you're going to start getting into localities and stuff that are more expensive than just your normal coastal. But a jungle to a jungle, you're still going to get really, you can still get really good-looking jungles that still are what people chase. A lot of entry-level people want just 100% just jungle because those are the ones that always catch their eye first. So I wouldn't even, if I was going to do that, I wouldn't even do coastal to coastal. I'd just do straight-up jungles and go that route because I think that is what people might want.
I feel that I owe it to the carpet python world to, you know, sort of keep the coastal, IJ, inland, that whole side, giving it as much attention as the jungle side of it. I mean, I realize that when you're at a show, I think of this. I think of way back when, Mike, when you used to do Hamburg, I remember walking around and then seeing Scattershot on your table and was like, oh, what the holy hell
the
is
hell
that?
Is that?
You know?
Yeah.
You know, so I realize that a coastal will never get that attention, but that being said, I think that you can, that there's still a lot of work that can be done with that, but, you know, I don't know,
here's my take on that whole thing. Okay. So now we've got some coastals that we want to work with. We want to produce some entry level stuff to get people really interested in the hobby, all right? And we don't want to sell a $600 jungle for $100 just because it's entry level, okay?
Right.
Now, we can all see the beauty in a really nice coastal animal, all right? Which is the reason that, like, my Russian line, I love working with those animals there because the variability and the unique beauty in each individual animal. Now, I used to work with a guy named Scott Terry. He was a tattoo artist. All right, he still does, great artist. And his philosophy on the client that comes in that only has a certain amount of money to work with is, if he's not doing anything, and what the client wants and what he's able to provide for the money don't match up, let's say the client only has $60, he's going to give him a $60 tattoo, but he's going to give him the best $60 tattoo he's ever had in his entire life. Mm-hmm. And that way, when he's hooked, he'll always come back, all right?
Right.
He'll always come back. So we can do that in selective breeding for entry and still do a great job saying, hey, look at the beauty in this animal right here, we can do this one for 100, or we can do this for 125. And maybe non-locality, just a really pretty animal, you know,
right.
That maybe won't command the $500 or $600 that, you know, a trophy jungle is going to.
Right. Right. Yeah, I mean that makes sense. I think. Do you feel that the carpet python? What's your take on the market? Do you see it growing? Do you see it kind of stagnant? Do you see more people interested in getting into it, or what's your take?
I don't want to. Man, dude,
hard one.
Yeah. This is what I put it out there. I'll put it out there.
Okay.
Me and Owen were talking about this the other day. Maybe I'll.
We do this a lot.
Yeah. So I was saying to him that 2 years ago when I produced, was it 2 years ago? Yeah, Zebra Jags for the first time. I kind of thought that people would be like, oh my God, Zebra Jags, I can't believe it, it's the greatest thing. But I really didn't get that. And I think me and Jason Balin, Kerry King, we were probably the people that I can think of, that I know of, that really had them in the States at the time. And people weren't really banging down the door to get them. I kind of thought that maybe a lot of people had just purchased Zebras and they had a Jag. Everybody had Jags.
Right.
So they were just going to make it their own themselves if they wanted a Zebra Jag. And I think Owen might be going through the same thing with Caramel Jags this year. You know what I mean? It's kind of like he has these beautiful
Everybody's
caramels.
Everybody's got the caramel jag and the caramel, so why buy a super caramel? I'm just going to make it in a few years.
Right. So it seems like to me that would lead me to think that there's a bit of saturation maybe. I don't know if that's the right word or the right term, but I think that there's more people than ever that are into carpets, but I don't know if it is relating to people running out there and, you know, buying all types of stuff.
I don't know. Okay, and this is where I don't want to piss anybody off. I don't know if I would call it saturation.
Okay.
I think it may have more to do with a lot more global accessibility. There's a lot more access to different mutations.
Right.
Number one, so they're more readily available, and the single genes that we're talking about. Man, I sound like a ball python guy. Those single genes that we're talking about. All right. They're available. You know. So, like you said, people, you know, they want to do their combos themselves. But when you asked me the initial overall question, as far as the market, I see excitement in the market, and in some aspects, I see people that are seeing some of the dollar signs and the new mutations, and they're chasing the genes. They're the guys that want to get on the ground floor of something new.
Right.
And, you know, some of the ball python guys are getting into carpets, which is great. More people that love carpets, the better, you know. But I'm just a little concerned that, you know, people are going to chase the animals for the genes and not the animals, you know.
That's where I'm
cautiously optimistic. I'm really excited about what's going on. There's so many, you know, different color and pattern mutations that we can get into now, you know, which is awesome. I just want to avoid some of the pitfalls of the whole ball python thing.
I don't ever think that carpet pythons will ever be anywhere near ball pythons. And even though ball pythons are kind of like, I think that people are kind of like, it seems to me like I hear, I don't know for a fact, but that they're bailing on stuff. But then you have other people that are still, you know, guns a-blazing, this is the greatest thing ever. And I think what you're going to see is you're going to see the people that really love ball pythons for ball pythons, and they're going to stick with them because they really enjoy doing them. And that's what you want. You're kind of weeding out the what you're saying, you know what I mean? And, hey, man, if you breed ball pythons and you love doing it, more power to you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, carpet pythons. I don't know. I see a lot of people getting, you know, excited about them, and I'm kind of very. I'll never lose my excitement about them, but I think that I do it more for me than I do for, you know, to breed to sell. But you know,
right,
I'm just
absolutely.
Curious of what you guys thought of what the market is, and then I guess when you tag in there the economy sucking,
yeah,
well, you know,
it's bad all around. I mean, I think Jordan Russell had a pair of monitors up for like $3,000 that I hear it was a travesty that they were even being sold at $3,000 or something like that.
Right, rare.
So, and nobody bought them at that insane of a price. So it's bad all around, and I know that people are still making sales. So I almost want to think like it's taken a lot longer for people to either save
the trigger.
Money for something that they want or pull the trigger for something that they want. And of course, things are getting better. And, of course, a lot of people who we know who are interested in the higher-end projects have their own animals that they have to sell in order to afford to jump into a project. So it's going to take some time, and I always imagine that it's in a little bit of an elastic band. And, you know, I'm moving in a couple months, so I'm perfectly happy sitting on whatever I have. Because I have no idea what my season's going to look like next year. So,
right.
You know, it's kind of like what Mike moved down the hall and had a bear of a time, and I'm going to drive my guys to an entirely new place, and I, you know, am terrified. So, yeah, I don't really mind that nothing's moving right now.
Sure, right. When, I mean, you move animals, and they know. You know, I know, I remember talking to Nick when he first built his new, he's got a standalone, you know, facility on his property. When he first put that up, you know, I know that first season was a bit of a challenge for him just because of the move, you know, cause they know it's true what they're used to. Things change, and they don't respond the same way.
Right. So, but we'll see.
Absolutely.
I imagine that things will get more interesting. I mean, also with carpets, you know, it does take a while for them to become pretty, especially in my case with the caramels. So, then they're just starting to hit their stride, so...
Oh yeah. I totally agree. You know, I've got a 2014 clutch of jungles that I haven't even told anybody about yet, and they're gonna hang up. That was a 31 egg clutch from jungles.
Jeez.
They're gonna sit here for a year.
How old
so,
is that team?
She is, she's 10 years old.
Nice.
She's 10. She's awesome. I'm going to sit on them and, you know, and I'm going to watch them color up and get real pretty. And as we were just talking about the economy, you know, I don't want to sell a $400 or $500, $600 jungle for $200 or $300 to get it out of my snake room. When I can look at it every day when I get home, you know. So,
yeah.
When I can enjoy it, forget your people.
I guess that's what I was trying to get at all along. It seems to me that if people, this is my fear when you're talking about other people seeing dollar signs and getting into it, is that they're just going to do it and they're going to breed. When they really shouldn't be producing that many clutches, let's say. You know, it's just for the sake of breeding this animal to that animal. I think that they're going to have a hard time selling that because, okay, well, let's just say if you have an animal, I have a pair of jungles. They're okay, they're decent, but they're not the greatest. and I just put them together. Chances are you're going to get maybe one, two standouts in the clutch, then you'll get some medium ones, and then you'll get ones that are on the lower end. But when you're going against, you know, proven, you know, pairings that produce stellar results, you're going to have a hard time, you know, selling, you know, well, say, like, say against you, Mike, if you have, like, you know, scattershot jungles, and, you know, I have no-name jungles that are just kind of, eh, you know what I mean? It's you're going to have a hard time getting that, whereas I think that you'll be able to sell much easier because you have genetics that, well, you have carpets that are proven to produce stellar animals, you know what I mean?
So, and variety. I mean, there's a right way to do things and the wrong thing. I mean,
I guess
you can't really just do that.
Yeah, if I guess the thing of it is that people just throw two pairs of carpets, a pair of carpets together just for the sake of producing, say, coastals or jungles or jags or caramel jags or whatever the case may be. They're going to have a harder time than somebody that actually put some thought behind what they're doing, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's it. Like, you know, when I first started really getting into it, you know, there were a couple times where it's like, man, what am I gonna put together? And if you're actually concerned about what you could possibly put together, then you probably shouldn't be putting anything together. You know, if you can't go in your snake room and say, man, I cannot wait until I can put that snake with that snake and see the babies that come out of that pairing. I mean, that's what I want to do. Like, you know, this season coming up, I plan on doing a few pairings. I plan on doing, of course, some ocelot stuff. And then the Russians and an ivory jag pairing. As far as carpets, that's probably going to be it.
Yeah.
You know, and then I have some other stuff that I've never bred before that I want to give it a shot, you know, some boa stuff. But
how do you find the transition from boas to pythons? Do you find that it is similar in keeping, or oh, this should be your question, Owen, not mine.
shut up. Shut.
In keeping, pretty similar.
Right.
Keep the boas a little bit cooler. You know, as far as breeding, I'll let you know. you know, again, like the first time I tried to breed boas was this year, and man, I couldn't get my rat snakes to breed this year. If that's any indication on how my season went, you know, it just everything moved and everything said, yeah, I'm not feeling it this year. So, doing the Argentines and a pair of Brazilian rainbows that I got from Julie Bender, I'm gonna pair those up. And from what I'm just through talking to a number of other people, I'm hearing humidity is a big thing. So I'm just going to keep that humidity up, and I'm going to cycle them similar to the way I cycle everything else. It's not a big room, so I don't have too many options. You know, as Chad was saying earlier, you know, when I'm raising temperatures or I'm lowering temperatures, the whole room's going. So
yeah.
Cool. So we'll see how this season goes. Hopefully we do well. I mean, I know there's a lot of ball python guys that are also do boas, and keep them pretty similarly. So I'm not overly concerned. We'll see. I'm pretty excited about it though. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. there's some cool stuff out there in the boa world. It seems like, though, I don't know, I guess maybe with what I find with Python people is that they don't venture into that world too much. They want to, but I don't see it too much. Oh, and no, he's going full guns a-blazing.
I did not go full guns a-blazing. I have Amazon tree boas, and I have Dominican Red Mountain boa.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I had a fake pair of Amazon tree boas. They wound up being 2 males, and it sucked.
Wow.
They hate me, and their cage is above me, so that was like the worst decision I ever made. So, you know, they're cool, and then the Dominicans are cool. It's just, you know, I'm fighting with the babies right now to get them to eat. So
it is
what it is. But
I'll get
Eric to grab some of those, and then he'll somehow, like, be calling you for, you know, Brazilian rainbows, because then eventually he'll just bite on that and I'll be off to the races down that path, too. So.
Nah.
Well,
I got to tell you, they are one of those species that when I was a kid, I don't know what it was, the colors or whatever, but I used to look, and I hear, you know, doing the show, I hear people all the time talk about, you know, when they were a kid and how they looked at, you know, snakes, and rainbow boas were always that one that was like that unattainable species to work with, and they were just so cool and so different than any kind of boa that you would see, and it was like, oh man, one day I wanna work with them. That's cool, you know.
I've had a few of them, and you know, it's just always, something's always gotten in the way of me actually getting them raised up to adulthood to where I can breed them. It's always like, you know what, I gotta sell something, I gotta move something, you know. And something's always gotten in the way for certain. I mean, like the Brazilian, that's like my white whale, you know. Well, something's always happened, so I'm kind of determined. And I'm sure we can work something out. I mean, you heard I'm downsizing, so I'm sure we can work something out for Amazon tree boas and Dominicans, right?
Yeah. Well, I got a bunch of baby Dominicans right now that I'm trying to get to eat along with my adult pair. So I'm trying to get them to eat something other than like quail or gecko. But you know, once we avoid that,
I'm waiting till Owen gets them going and they're all good to go, and then I'm going to hit them with some crazy carpet python morph, and I'm going to say, hey,
get
Owen, back,
get away from me. Don't you lose my phone number. Get away from me with that.
Hey,
what is crap?
What do the colors look like on your adults, on your Dominicans?
My female is absolutely gorgeous. My male, but you know, he's not a slouch, but she's prettier. But the babies, there are some of them that came out. They're starting to shed now, so they're bright orange or dark red. So, you know, short answer, I have no idea. So what the hell I'm looking at. So we'll see.
Yeah,
that's scary. I might have to jump in.
Yeah.
Owen just literally picked up the female, and then like the 2 days later, she lays a litter of babies, and he's like,
she bursts them out, and I'm like, oh, what the hell do I do? It was horrible.
Yeah.
Oh boy. But so she dropped right after you bought her?
Yeah. She dropped 2 days after. She was here for 2 days and dropped here in the cage, and it smelled.
No.
To high hell. But, you know, just dropped them 2 days after being here.
Oh, wow, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm. So.
The luck of some of these people.
The luck of some of these people. You bastards. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. So.
That's very cool. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. But now, of course, like I said, I got a bunch of babies that are, like, I got people going like, you're going to have to use geckos. And I'm like, the hell I am. We're going to find something else to do other than house geckos. So, you know.
Oh, wait. Talking about animals that you love and, you know, that are challenging, you know, wait till you Will you work with any blackheads yet?
No, I do not work with blackheads. I don't actually have any of the expedites, which is interesting. Well, don't know why that is.
Wait till you're trying to get them going.
Did you do the Derek Roddy route where you just don't even waste time? You just
force feed them the second they shed.
Yep. And unfortunately, I bought blackheads from Derek, of course, and he says, yeah, they'll go for you, no problems. All right, cool. Because I had one pair that I had bought in elsewhere, and they'd breed every year and never get any eggs. And I'm talking to Derek, he's like, yeah, my pair will breed for you. They'll go. All right, cool. So first time I bred them, got 5 eggs. Out of those 5, 4 of them perfectly healthy babies. One of them was dead in the egg, but they all went the distance my first attempt. So, okay, you know, I consider that a great success. And assist feeding, you know, I was doing once every 7 days to 10 days, and hoping they would start taking on their own. And I lost one, then I lost another. I wound up with just one baby making it, and, you know, I'm talking to Derek, and I, you know, he's like, were you assisting him? And I, absolutely, you know. He said, well, how often are you doing it? So, you know, I told him, I'm used to, if you have to assist feed an animal, typically you're just trying to kickstart the digestion.
Right.
And, you know, get them to want to eat. So every 7 to 10 days is fine, and then they'll, as soon as they poop, they'll want to eat a meal. And he says, no, man, he says, every, you know, you got to do it, just do it more often. So sure enough, you know, one of them went for me, lesson learned, and, you know, I'll probably try them again in another year and a half. So,
wow.
But that's easy. Can be a challenging species, you know, to start off with when you haven't done them before. Got a pretty strong learning curve, you know. But
so, how many days does he recommend? Like every 3 days or something, feeding them, or
every like 4 or 5, I believe.
Is it just because they have a fast metabolism or something like that, where they just need the food that often?
I believe it's more of a teaching them that rodents are food.
Right.
Yeah.
I got an. Crap. How come? Oh man, how come people don't just like breed geckos for species like that?
I'm going to have to do that. That's what we're going towards here. I'll do that. So, you know.
Do you think it's the whole, like, feeding a reptile to a reptile thing, or do you think?
I don't know. It's probably, you know, I personally, I've got all these snakes, so I don't want to be spending all the, you know, that much more time breeding geckos and caring for geckos. To feed to snakes, you know, that's my thing.
Right.
So
it's almost like people with cobras who, you know, talk to their friends with corn snakes and stuff, and that's, they feed that, or the ball
bat
or something like that. I mean, there's always that stuff, but, I mean, from what I've told, is a lot of people just when they have these species that only eat lizards or birds or something like that, there are ways around it where they'll get like a shipment of house geckos from like someplace and raise them up, and once the babies are all on rodents, there's no need for the house geckos anymore, so they just burn off the colony or something like that. So I don't know.
Right.
But.
Yeah, I mean for me it's more of a convenience thing. You know, where it's easier to to just try and get them on rodents as soon as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
I wonder why, though, like, I know, like, I guess, like, us personally, if you're keeping them, why you wouldn't breed, you know, geckos for that. But I wonder why, like, feeder guys or girls don't do that.
Okay.
You know what I mean? You know,
right,
like
right.
A... I mean, they do quail, they do mice, rats, African soft furs. You think that they would say, here's an idea. Why don't I breed an easy-to-breed gecko species? And a lot of these guys that have these harder-to-get-going snakes, because I would think once you get it going, maybe it would be easier to switch them once. Because I think blackheads, I know mine, they pretty much will eat anything, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Once they're going,
you know,
they're
mine...
going, you know.
Mine too, you know, absolutely anything. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I know, I mean, there are some feeder dealers out there, you know, that sell frozen geckos, but I'm sure that's all wild-caught stuff.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
That's one of the things that, you know, I can, normally I get chicks and stuff from, for my Macklots only eat chicken, which is stupid. But but for these for little boas, I actually have to try to track down a day-old quail. And
right.
My rodent supplier does not do that. And I actually have to put in an order to someplace like Rodent Pro to get the quail for the size that I need to try to feed these little boas to get them on the road.
Yeah.
So it is what it is. And then... You know, it also becomes with supply versus, you know, demand and stuff like that, where a place like Rodent Pro doesn't just cater to the reptile market. They also supply zoos and other places like that. So having day-old quail for them works. My local
yeah,
guy is
absolutely.
Do that for the gecko thing. So it is what it is. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's not, I mean, if you think about it, these hard to get started, these reptile feeding snakes, how many people are really breeding them right now, you know, to create that big of a demand?
I think the African soft furs were even a thing is there was such a demand with the ball python breeders that they be brought in, bred or whatever, that just kind of led to it. So if everybody got all that, like everybody got these animals that were difficult to breed, or difficult to get going, there would be more of a demand. But I also feel that as you move down the generations, you get more and more animals that are easier to feed because the ones that won't feed kind of die off, and maybe you get ones that just instinctively go towards mice because that's what their parents did. So maybe get that, weed that stuff out.
Right,
I don't
right.
know if that works with blackheads, though, because...
Oh, I know. Valid point.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? That's I don't know if that will or not. I mean, time will tell because people are breeding them more regularly, you know, and getting them started faster. So who knows? Like you were saying, I mean, my adults they'll eat anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
They're like garbage disposals.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'm on the Jersey Shore, and this time of year, it's crabbing season, and I feed chicken necks. Chicken necks are great. Give them to the blackheads. Give them to I've got a jungle female Eve that eats nothing but chicken parts.
Really?
That's yeah. Huh. She doesn't want nothing to do with mice, nothing to do with rats. She actually turned down quail the other day. What is the matter with you? You throw a drumstick in there and yeah. Done.
Game on.
Yeah,
wow.
Absolutely. You know, so that's what she eats. And she does great with them. My 2013, she maternally incubated a clutch on nothing but a diet of chicken parts.
Huh.
So
ugh,
she
wow.
did a great job with it. It's just a little inconvenient, but not too big a deal.
Well, they're just some of those snakes, because like I said, my Maclot's Python male only eats chicken, and I'm actually going to start getting him some quail that are a little bit older and bigger because he needs to put on some more size. But it's a mild inconvenience. But you know what? Chicks are 30 cents, and I can get a whole big bag. And then you know what? The scrubs enjoy chicks too. So, you know, it's whatever.
Right.
It's a little inconvenient, and yeah, he has to eat five of them at a sitting. But you know what? It's And the stuff that comes out of him is horrible, but it's whatever. Are you eating? Are you growing? Are you healthy? Are you going to breed with the female? Cool. So, yeah.
Sure. Well, if you have access to chicken necks, try them out on that. I'm telling you, it's...
Chicken necks.
Yep.
I'm going to try that.
Try them out and I'll probably take them.
I might be able to. It's going to go to, like, the market, the farmer's market or something. I mean, I imagine I can get them there. So.
Yeah, sure.
Jeez.
Conveniently, I run a grocery store, so it's...
Conveniently, he's right.
There you go.
It should be pretty simple.
It's almost like you can order things and get food of various kinds.
Yeah. That's cool. What other projects are you working with, Mike? You got the blackheads, the boas, anything else that you got?
I still do the spotteds, and I actually got a couple ball python pairings.
That's okay, Mike, because I got them too.
It's all right. Okay.
I've got the Lucy Texas rat snakes. They've always been my favorites, you know, as far as colubrids. And I still have a pair of those. They're really cool. That's pretty much it. The ball pythons, I got some pieds and some het pieds and a pair of albinos. My 11-year-old, he's a ball python kid. You know,
okay.
When I bought Papillon, the sire to Jigsaw, we went to a reptile show, and right next to Jay's table is a beautiful pied, and it was like $3,000, $3,000, $3,500, somewhere around there, and he took one look at it, and he says, "Dad, it's a piebald ball python. Can we get it?" And he was so excited. and I had to tell him no. He was actually a friend of mine, had a couple of health problems and got rid of a bunch of his animals and just called me up and said, "Hey, can you just take my animals for me?" And one of them was a nice pied female, and he says, "Give this to your son for me." So I said, "All right." So I came home and I said, "Hey, here you go. It's from Frank." I bought a male to go with her, and there's the heads that are her parents.
Mm-hmm.
We got that. Then I'm doing Womas this year again. I'm going to try them. I bred them, you know, for a few years, and the adults that I had, I wanted to kind of upgrade to something a little bit brighter, a little more higher contrast. So I sold my proven adults, and I got some younger stuff. And I've got a really nice pair, a proven male from John Floyd. That's a rare earth lineage. And I got a really nice female that I got a steal on her. Somebody came up to me at a Hamburg show that I was vending, probably the last show that I vended, and she was deep in shed, and even in shed, she looked beautiful. I didn't realize she was in shed until I looked at her eyes when I first saw her. I just caught a glimpse. I'm like, "Man, that's a nice woman. Holy cow, she's in shed." So she's she just has not been receptive. We'll give that bear a try this year and see what happens. But that's pretty much it, you know, other than the carpets. Got that, and it'll be another year before I try the blackheads again.
Cool. Any carpet projects that you're looking to expand into, or you have your fill?
You set with your stuff?
You know what? I'm pretty set with my stuff. Some of the Stripe Jungle stuff. I'd really like to get into. And probably plug that into the Ocelot stuff. I'm looking to expand into Bolins, and having chat on earlier, it's like, oh man, I got
to rub the salt into it.
But that's something that I've wanted to do, is Bolins. And, you know, again, outside of carpets, the Amazon basins. I've always wanted them, and I almost bought a pair from Ralph Colanello at White Plains years back, and I went with carpets instead. I wound up, I think I bought a pair of Bradley at that show. But that's one of those things where it's like I've really wanted to work with them. So,
yeah, they're another one of those species that as a kid, you, at least for me, you're kind of like, wow, one day.
And then I'm actually, you know, in the not-so-distant future, the prehensile-tailed skinks. Them back when they were like, $100 a piece when I had them. And I only had a handful of them, and I didn't know enough about husbandry and breeding at the time to where I was actually able to know the ins and outs of compatibility and of groups and what have you. But I've always missed them, and I actually, a year or so ago, I'm like, man, I really miss my skinks, and I'm like, let me see if anybody's got any for sale, and I saw the price tag, I'm like, what happened?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Solomon Islands are closed.
We came from this ones, and the price went from like 400 3,000 overnight, and I know a few people who have like a bunch of them and are like kicking themselves.
But that's something else that I'd like to in the future work with, and just more of an experience than anything. They're cool, pretty cool animals. But that's about it.
Yeah, I found over the past year that I had a goal of at least picking up females from different species of pythons, diamonds being one of them. I picked up a pair of them. Now next year is Bolins. You know, it's funny. I was talking to Nick earlier, and we were talking about the shipment from Paul and whatnot for this upcoming year, and I'm like, I don't know if there's anything left for me to get, Nick. I think you're pretty much done.
Until there's something new cropping up over there. I mean, you know.
There's really maybe some double heads type of stuff, to get ahead on those type of projects.
I find it funny that you explained your whole plan to me, that you're going to pick up females of animals that you want. And I'm like, sounds like a good idea. And then one week you picked up a bunch of females. And then you're like, all right, and then I'll wait till next year to pick up the males. And then a week goes by and you buy a bunch of boys. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. What happened to your plan of waiting a year? But the male was so pretty. I'm like, ah, well, never mind. It's, never mind. It's over now.
I learned, I learned that when I was getting into carpets. It's like if you see a pairing, a specific pairing that you
just
want something from, you never know what's going to happen, man. You know, you don't know if that pairing's ever going to go again. You don't ever know if the people that you know that have those animals, if they don't sell them off or whatever. I can always sell it later, you know, if it's something.
Right, I just found it funny you had this whole big grand plan and then it went to hell in 2 weeks. It's like, I got all the females and then all the boys showed up. Like, oh, well, never mind. So,
if you see it, that's the time to buy it.
That is true.
So Bolins are my next this coming year. By next year at this time, I'll have a pair of Bolins pythons.
So mark your calendars, kids. Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
They're
just, I don't know, there's something about those that, you know. Rough scale, like I've been kind of gearing my projects to be altering what Owen's doing, so that way.
We can share cables and it's not bad.
Well, not only that, white lips, like I really love white lips and I would like to have some, but why should I try to breed them if Owen's trying to breed them when I have something that I'll breed over here that maybe he'll want, and then we can just, you know,
So Owen do the heavy lifting.
When I breed ring pythons, you know, you'll want a pair.
Touche. Touche. Okay. I stand corrected. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's cool. Yeah. How about with your Antaresia, your granite spotted, were they difficult to get going?
No, not at all. They produce this year. They go pretty much every year. They're bulletproof. You know, I actually get them started on frozen thawed pinks, mouse pinks. Very rarely, every once in a while, I'll have one that just needs a live one. But for the most part, they're pretty straightforward. I believe the pygmies are a little bit harder. And that's something that I've kind of kicked around the idea of doing those just because they're pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a female pygmy python. Very cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Cool. That was one of the part of the plan.
We haven't found a breeding that we want a boy from yet. The only reason we still got just the girl.
Yeah.
Unless the boy's on his way.
No. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah, they're pretty good, pretty easy to get started. It's funny, man. You give them such a tiny pinky, and they still look like they swallowed a football. You know, they're so tiny. And that's like we were talking about earlier. You know, as far as breeding stuff that you enjoy, that's one of those animals that they're really neat animals. They're just cool little snakes, and I breed them every year. Just because I enjoy it, and it's allowing the female to maternally incubate is super cool also because it's such a small python that, and you're seeing these little tiny heads popping out from in between her coils. That's really wild to watch. It's cool on any python species, but especially them because they're so tiny. It's really enjoyable.
I have an adult children's python that I got
female.
As an adult, like a proven female, and I got her last year. And when I opened up the box when she came in, I was like, "What? This is a proven female? What? It's laid how many eggs? What?" You know, when you're used to dealing with carpet pythons, you're seeing this. I'm like, really? No, it's kind of wild, you know. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, they're Definitely. My spotted, you know, she's about 3 feet long, and you know, she drops eight or nine eggs a year. And when you look at them, you wouldn't think of them, you know. And I mean, I'm sure you guys, as soon as people find out we're into pythons, they're like, oh, I can't have anything big, you know. I can't have anything. You work with those big snakes.
Yep.
Well,
not all of them.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Python does not equal 30-foot retic, okay? You know, some people don't see that.
Yeah, and the average person, though, that's what they think, that's for sure.
Really? And back in the day, I mean, my first constrictor was a retic. And that, you know, that male, when I gave him away, he was 16 feet long. He was puppy dog tame. But that's a 16-foot snake. That's as big around as your thigh. And
right.
People think python, they think giant snake. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Retics are that's a whole nother a whole nother can of worms right there. But
yeah.
So pretty.
Fun. If I had the room, if I had the room and the time, I'd probably keep this about it. I mean, the list goes on.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's so cool about the different species in general. You know, we're talking a bit, you know, between carpets and womas and retics and bolins, and each of them have that distinct different personality, you know. That distinct demeanor, which is, it's really neat. I mean, you know, my Darwins versus my jungles, there's such a difference in, how docile they are, and just their overall behavior. Then you go, I know roughies are a lot different. And then you look at the Brettles and the Bowl. I mean, just within each different individual species, it's really cool to just observe the different trends in behavior.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you can learn that. Well, this is kind of why I have some ball pythons, is because one of the things that I, you know, when I'm talking on the show to people, and it's kind of like, I have no real experience with breeding them, you know, and they're a python, and I don't know, they get a bad rap, and I understand why, but there's some stuff out there that I kind of dig. I even just a regular ball python with like nice high contrast. I don't know, man. I think they're cool. When I was a kid, I thought they were cool.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you have some normals?
I do.
What kind of ball pythons do you have?
Let's see. I have an albino, a het pied, a normal, a pair of desert ghost or het desert ghost, and a leopard pastel male. That's it.
Because, you know, Talking to some people, you know, you hear about. Well, I've heard from several people that there's so many normals out there that are actually hets for something. That
I've heard that. That people even burn out the hets.
Yeah. Where you just, you know, just picture going to Petco and buying a bunch of ball pythons and breeding them, and you know, who knows what's coming out of that.
Yeah.
You know, so
I've even thought about that with carpets, like as far as it's not that I would not, like if I would ever make possets anything, I would just sell them as normals,
right,
and just tell them that, hey, listen, this is a possibility that this would be a posset albino. whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, same type of thing.
When I, not this past season, but the season before, was the first season I produced ball pythons. And I did a possible het snow to an albino, and I did a het pied pairing. And, man, I tell you, it seemed like it was a completely different ball game than the carpets. You know, with the carpets, I'd open the eggs and they'd come out. And with the balls, I opened the eggs and they stayed there. And
it's called action. Like, get out.
And as a result, you know, I guess about a quarter of them didn't make it. They just died in the eggs after they were opened up.
Did they drown?
I guess, yeah. It looked that way. I mean,
I didn't reserve that milk.
And it's like, man, it's like, you got to be kidding me. but because they're ball pythons, I didn't really label them or, you know, I just said, okay, let me get them in tubs, get them set up, and, you know, these are in this row, and get them eating and whatever. So, I mean, they're all possible hets because I mixed them up. I don't know which one's which. So, it's great when you're at a show and you've got young kids with their parents that are looking to get their first snake.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say, hey, look, here's this ball python is not going to bite you and eats every time you try and feed it and enjoy this snake, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And by the same token, I've sold carpets the same way where, okay, this one's pretty chill. And, you know, the baby carpets are baby carpets.
Yeah.
I've had kids come with their parents like, no, I want that one. But it bites. I don't care that it bites. I want, and...
Okay.
I'm sure you guys know, like, when I was a kid, I didn't care if it bit. It was cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember having Tokay geckos.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, 10 years old with Tokay geckos, I'd bark and be hanging off my finger, and you know, and Dad's looking at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah, God. That was fun. I've had those too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They're like,
you know,
the pit bulls of the gecko world, you know.
Yeah, sure. But I think that all ties into what we were talking about. It's all about that passion. It's all about, you know, what is gonna excite you the most,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the end of the day. What are you excited to keep?
Yeah. I mean, you're ultimately, your collection is for you. I mean, as much as you might want to say that it's for resale or for selling or for, it is your collection, and you should keep stuff that you enjoy. Yeah, you can have a pair, like I have corn snakes. I don't really particularly like the corn snakes that much. They're just filthy. They crap every day. But it's from the same point that you have, Mike, where it's like, listen, these carpetons, they're not really that great of pets. These baby corn snakes are going to be fantastic pets. And they're kind of native to the area, so they're pretty bulletproof if you do it just kind of right. So, you know, right. They're much more forgiving than this thing. So, but you know, when it comes to everything else, like I have two male rough scales right now. And everybody keeps telling me that I don't have a pair of rough scales. I have two boys, but I just find them so cool that I don't really give a damn that they can't breed right now. I just think they're awesome. So you should have what you want in your collection, not what the market dictates.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. You know,
yeah.
And I think that goes in hand with, you know, what I said earlier about that best $60 tattoo ever is if you have what you want, if you have what you're passionate about, you're going to produce the prettiest babies. You're going to take that much better care of what you have, and you're going to take that much more of an interest in what you're working with if you're passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
If it's dollar signs, well, it's a commodity. You know, if it's your passion, you're gonna be invested in it. You know, emotionally as well as financially.
Yeah. And it's always cool to see the next step being taken. You know, I mean, I raised up my caramels from babies, and now I got their kids, and I'm already lining up for what the next step will be for who I'm going to be crossing their kids with. And I'm starting to get some new stuff in to make better, bigger, better stuff. So it's cool to take down that stuff. So.
Yeah, me too. I've got the same. We're probably right on the same track with the caramels. Yeah.
Sweet.
probably got the babies at the same time.
Yeah, I think we did pretty close at the same time, because I remember you got yours around the same tick. So,
yeah. No doubt, man.
I went straight for the Frankensnakes. So
yeah, you went left and kept going left. So yeah.
Yeah,
you know what's
funny?
Seems like,
what's that?
I was talking to Nick today, and it was like we were talking about. We were talking about anti-aging stuff, and I was asking him, I said, do you think that things will change and there'll be more of a focus on that once morphs start popping up over here and whatnot? And, you know, he's like, yeah, and then I'm not looking forward to everybody kind of mixing everything up. And, you know, it's weird for me. It's like that thought never would even cross my mind. But for some reason, I'm trying to figure out why I think it's okay for carpets. You know, like, why is it okay for me to cross carpets, but I wouldn't do that with other things, you know? It's weird.
But we all have our lines. Like, you know, Mike isn't taking an Ocelot and breeding it to a Bolens, or to a Brettle. I mean, he isn't going that far, so.
I know, but it's just weird that, like, why is it? I was thinking about it out loud with him, and I was saying, you know, I guess when I was getting into carpets, it was okay. People did it, you know? So was kind of like, yeah, I guess this is cool. Wow, look at that. Wow, that's cool.
And
you know.
And now, when you're looking at carpets, I mean, people. There's a lot of people that are coming into the hobby right now, as far as carpets, that aren't making the distinction between, you know, coastals and jungles and what have you. There was a lot of mixing, right along. But you still had your, okay, this is a coastal and this is a jungle and whatnot. And then the talk of jungles and coastals being genetically identical, all right? So it's all the same snake.
Right.
And I don't know how much research has been done with Aneresia. Is, you know, genetically, how different are they? And I think
I think
that's a valid concern also, because for the most part, because let's say you've got your jungle and your Irian Jaya or your coastal, all right, and then you have a cross between the two, you can kind of say, okay, you know what, that's not a jungle and that's not a coastal and that's not an IJ.
Right.
You do that with a spotted and a children's, and or a children's and a Stimson's, you know, even better. And you say, okay, now which is which, you know, and you have babies that are similar,
right?
Very very similar to both parents. Now you're going to have trouble differentiating.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think I. for some reason, to me, I guess the other part of it is that as much as research would say that maybe this isn't the case, when it comes to taxonomy, it always blows my mind how people kind of follow what they're told. Well, what I mean by that is just recently they took scrub pythons and bolans and Owen Pelly, and they moved them out of Morelia. And, you know, everybody just kind of was like, okay, I'll go along with that. But, you know, if your whole thing is like, I'm only working with them because they're Morelia, now I can't work with them anymore. You know what I mean? Like, so mm-hmm. with carpets, to me, I kind of look at that, and I know this isn't probably the, you know, I look at imbricatas being separate. I look at brettles as being separate. I look at inlands on a trajectory to be different. At one point, you know, I think in maybe okay. thousands of years from now, I think inlands will be their own thing. But to me, like coastals, Darwins, jungles, and even IJs, to me, they're all really kind of the same thing. That's how I see them. You know what I mean? I know that they're separate, and but right. really, has there been that much work done with them to really show that they're not? You know, if that makes sense. I mean, I know that distinctly they look different because they come from said locality or, you know,
right, sure.
this part of Australia or whatever, but I don't know. That's just me thinking out loud.
Yeah, I'm following that, you know.
And I guess that's why, deep down inside, why I think it's okay to cross, like, you know, to make a jungle jag or a granite jag or whatever, but I don't see, like, to me, I wouldn't make an inland jag, or I wouldn't make an inland albino. I wouldn't make a brettle jag, although they're cool, and I really do appreciate how some of them look. It wouldn't be something that I would go after. I might even keep one as a pet, but it's not something that I'm gonna breed. You know what I mean?
Right. That's when we get into, okay, well, what are we? We're keeping snakes in a box, you know. Mm-hmm. I think some of the hybrids, even the more extreme hybrids, I think they're really cool looking. Probably wouldn't, you know, go for that myself, but they're pretty neat looking. What I see also is, you know, people are starting to do, you know, inland jags and whatnot and those other crosses. And I kind of wonder how muddy is that going to get?
Pretty bad,
yeah.
I think. You know,
I guess
I just don't understand what the purpose would be, you know? I don't get what you would...
Well, you know, probably... You know, the same purpose in me doing ivory jags, right?
Yeah,
it's one of those things of where do you draw that line, you know? And then we get into the moral relativism, so to speak, where it's like, okay, well, it's okay for you to do this, but not this, and then we have to. Decide, okay, well, are we trying to impose our own ideals of what's the best onto somebody else when they're just kind of keeping snakes in a box?
Yeah, I really don't give a shit what anybody does, and I would never down them for doing what they do. You know what I mean? To me, that's their own prerogative. Whenever I speak about that, I speak about, you know, my own, like, trying to figure out why I think the way I think. Like, what is it that draws me to make said decisions about why, where my line in the sand is that I won't cross, you know? Like, when you sit there and you think about it, you're right. You're keeping a snake in a box. So why wouldn't I take a chondro and breed it to a carpet, you know?
Right. So. And I've actually given that thought, and, you know, where... For me personally, you know, I need, if I'm going to really like the way that adult looks, you know, then I'll go for it. you know, when I look at two different animals, and you know the deal when you're at a show, every show you're going to have at least one or two people come up to you and say, "Hey, I've got an Aryan Jaya. What could I breed to it? You know, that's going to sell, or what can I breed to it that's going to baby's going to be really incredible." And usually, what I'll tell them is, you get the hottest, most beautiful Aryan Jaya you can find,
right,
and that's what you do. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is, basically you want the sum to be better. You want the finished product to be better than both of the parents. You know,
yeah.
And usually,
yeah,
what what's happening when you do some of those crosses is it actually detracts from some of the best qualities, and you get kind of a muddy in the mix kind of thing. So,
uh-huh,
certain animals, you know, like with Carpandros, I've seen some of them that have been really cool. The majority of them I haven't liked. You know,
yeah,
and it's weird. There's so much variability between the results, between the offspring. I've seen someone say, "Man, I'd want one of those," and others where it's like, "Yeah, I don't like that."
Yeah, I mean, to me, like, if you take a Carpandro, it's kind of like you're taking two snakes that I absolutely, you know, go gaga over, and kind of mixing them into this one snake, and it kind of loses why I like both of those snakes. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
yeah,
it's kind of like, yeah, it's like, okay, this is cool, and I really like this, and this is cool, and I really like that, but this is why I like the fact that they're different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I like the fact that I see a green snake on a stick, and I like the fact that this is, you know, yellow and black, or, you know, chestnut brown and, you know, black too, or whatever the case may be, whatever you're doing, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
kind of, I don't know.
And I think that's one of the reasons that when I answer that question, I mean, because you know you inevitably get that question. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Whenever I answer that question, it's kind of like, okay, you take the qualities that you like best about that animal, and you find another animal with either similar or better qualities, and you try and do the best pairing possible to bring those qualities out that you like best, you know. And you have a hard time doing that when you're breeding animals that are completely opposite, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's almost like I get a feeling like some people that are into that type of thing, they're almost chasing like the ball python dream of making the most crazy looking snake possible. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, how do we make the craziest looking snake possible when this snake doesn't have any morphs like the ball python? So let me just breed it to another species and look at this. You know?
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
I've seen that with someone, and you know, for some people, I know it's a case of wanting to do something that hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
And seeing how far you can push the limits of nature, what nature will allow, you know. And which I can kind of get that, you know, that sense of the wanting to explore those limits. You know, I can
sure.
definitely kind of get that. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that draws us to snakes in general, I mean, it's not so much now, but, you know, when I got into snakes, well, everyone was, why would you want to pet snake? You can't cuddle. I mean, how many times you hear you can't cuddle with it?
Oh,
cuddle
yeah.
with it, or can't hug it. I'm like, okay.
And, you know, but it's the intrigue, you know. And, you know, people ask me the same question about snakes as they do about body piercing. You know, and when I was always drawn, you know, and I give them the same answer for both National Geographic
You know,
nice.
Being a kid, you know, I was seeing all these cool animals from all over the world and all these cool cultures from all over the world and all kinds of body art from all over the world. It's like, and it stuck with me. You know, so it's the intrigue that that's what captures us to when we're young. That's captures us to start.
Right. There we go. I thought my mic was muted for a sec. Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you there.
Yeah.
I don't know. Definitely. There's just so many species of snakes to work with. It just seems like, to me, what's the point of doing it? But I guess when you put it in that perspective of, you know, trying to push the boundaries of nature, kind of, you know, I can see that. I can absolutely see that.
I mean,
you're trying to figure out nature in a box, you know? It's kind of like,
I'm sure.
I'm always fascinated by, I'm more of the guy that, like, I'm trying to figure out what makes this thing tick. You know, what really is going on inside this snake, and why does it do the things that it does? Which led me to work with a bunch of different species rather than just carpets, because I feel that I would gain more knowledge about snakes and pythons in general by working with a variety of species rather than just being, you know, stuck in this one type. You know, I think that it would only make my knowledge for, you know, carpets that much stronger. So.
Oh, same here, and not just that, but the enrichment you get from different species and you know, like we were talking about earlier, the ways in which they're so different, you know.
Right.
You know, and so each different species is so unique. So that in and of itself is fulfilling and instructive. I mean, you learn so much from doing it.
Heck yeah. So, but, we're going to be running out of time soon. So it's funny how these shows go by so quick, but, so,
very cool.
I was just going to ask, like, you know, your website or Facebook, or how do people get in touch with
all
you?
I'm at just about every White Plains show. And then the best way to get in touch with me would be my Facebook.
Okay.
If you just go facebook.com/scattershotexotics with an X.
Got it.
And that's the best way to get in touch with me. That or curtinherps@yahoo.com. And that's curtin, CURTIN, herps.
Cool.
At Yahoo.
Cool, cool, cool.
Cool.
All right, Mike.
Cool.
Thanks for hanging out with us tonight and talking with us.
My pleasure.
Welcome back anytime, and hopefully we'll see you next month up at White Plains.
Yeah, man. I look forward to it. And hopefully the next 6 months or so, I'm going to try to start doing a hamburger again.
Oh, there you go.
I'm hoping for it, you know. But we'll see what happens.
Okay.
That'll be cool.
All right. Gentlemen, good talking to you.
Likewise.
All right, have a great night.
You too.
You too.
Right. Bye-bye. All
right. All right, Owen. I guess let's wrap this baby up.
Yep.
And get going. First and foremost, MorelliaPython.com. Go check it out, the forum. Just so everybody knows, the hope is that everybody will get over there, post up their pictures, and then we'll kind of jumpstart that whole forum again, but you know, people are having some trouble with posting up pics. You know, you got to be a member in order to post up pics.
Yeah, you do have to be a member.
Yeah, so that's kind of the idea. So anyway, the Morelia Python Radio 2015 calendar is underway. There's a couple weeks you have to get your pictures taken and post them up. We have every category for, let's see, we have Darwin's, Jungles, Coastals, IJs, Diamonds, what else? Inlands, Brettles, Scrubs, Chondros, Bolins, and the miscellaneous category. But all the categories are over there. All you have to do is just post up your picture, put what category it is for, and put a little bit of info about the animal up there. You know, you can put morphs of, you know, the different species or subspecies up there. And if you want to put, I guess, a morph that's a cross, put it under the miscellaneous one for now, and we'll do it that way. But, yeah, there's a thread over there. Like I said, 2015 Morelia Python Radio Calendar Contest. Just put it all underneath there, and we will be voting on that in a couple weeks. So hopefully, if everything goes well, we'll have the calendar ready for Tinley, which we will
hopefully
be at. You know, so let's hope that that works out. What else? Oh yeah, and also part of that gig is you have to like the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page. So you have to do that as well. As far as anything else with the show, check out the website moreliapythonradio.com. If you have any questions or comments or anything that you want relating to the show, you can send an email at info@moreliapythonradio.com. You can check us out on iTunes. Download the show from there. I had a couple people saying that they were having trouble from the Blog Talk page. I also
on the last show, yeah.
Yeah, it says it cuts out 15 minutes into it. I don't know. I didn't have any problems, and a few other people, they said they didn't have any problems. I don't know if it's the computer. I know that used to be an issue as far as, you know, people's computers and how they were set up with Blog Talk, where you had to open it up in a separate browser window. You know, I don't know if that's still the case or not. But if you – probably the easiest way is iTunes. Just subscribe to the show. And we'll just download right to your iPod, iPhone, iPad, whatever you got. You can also go over the website because I put the show after it's ready. I post up the new show of the week up on the homepage of MoreliaPythonRadio.com. So that's that. next week, who do we have next week?
I don't know. Tell the people.
Oh, next week it's just me and you.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, it's just a BS type of show. But we do have I did want to throw it out for David. I hope I'm saying his last name right, Brahms. Basically, he's doing a do-it-yourself cage kit. And he sent me one in the mail to try out. It's really actually very cool.
Okay.
So basically, you take a 56-quart tub, and I'm sure they have different tubs for different sizes, but it's basically the frame, and you get in the mail, you kind of put it together, and get yourself a couple, you can either get glass or acrylic, pop it in there, and he gives you the dimensions and the directions, super simple to do, and makes pretty decent cage for a pretty decent price, you know. So we're going to get him to come on and talk about it, and you know, but obviously that's not going to be a whole show about it, but
no, we can't throw that out.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we're just going to chat with them a little bit about it, and hopefully,
cool.
You know, more people will get into it. So, you know, it's perfect for a chondro type of case. It's similar to what Buddy had when we were down at his place.
Yeah,
same type of thing.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's that. The following week will be Kara from the Blood Cell. We'll be talking to her about blood pythons and selective breeding and et cetera, et cetera. And the following week we have Andrew Parris in the calendar contest. On the 23rd, I kind of had some scheduling conflicts, but we have Jason Balin that's going to be talking with us. And then, well, I thought it was fitting with the new page that he started up, Morelia, et cetera.
Yeah, Morelia, et cetera, and such. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. So obviously, we're going to be talking carpets with him, and then maybe some of his et cetera stuff. What led him to start that page and obviously Tinley Park Carpet Row. We'll talk a little bit about that. So that should be a good show. And then at the end of the month we have Chad Gray from Chad Gray Reptiles. And if you go check out his Chad Gray Reptiles, he's got Facebook and a web page. He's kind of like you, Owen. And I guess kind of like me now, too, but he has
There are not many people like me, but go on.
White lips, bolens, carpets.
Excellent.
Angolans,
I approve
rings.
Of all of this so far.
He has Antaresia. You name it, he's got it as far as playing.
There you go.
So should be cool to talk to him. I just want to throw this out here. At the end, next October... At the end of the month, on October 28th, it'll be our
next
third
October or
year.
This one coming? Yeah.
This one coming up,
yeah.
October 28th,
yeah.
3 years
Jesus Christ.
Here on NPR, 3 years. So.
Doing this for three goddamn years. I mean, I just...
yeah.
So touching.
So that'll be a special show, and we'll just have some special guests stopping by and chat with us for a little bit and whatnot. So that should be a fun show.
Again, the people will not notice, but we will be in our formal attire and our tuxedos. But of course, being a radio show, you can't see us. So you're just going to have to believe us.
Yeah. No fear, Owen. Soon enough, we will maybe have webcams that they will see us. They will no longer tune into the show after that.
Everyone has already said that I have a face for radio, and I'm not really sure what that means, but...
It's probably not a good thing, but...
Pretty sure it's bad.
Yeah.
Anyway,
So yeah, that's what's kind of lined up for the show. I'm trying to line up for the rest of the year, so we pretty much know what's on the docket to take us out.
Is that after the anniversary show, it's like downhill to the Christmas special, and then we do the holiday special, and then we're just gone for like a month, and then we have to come back. And I love the show, the first show we do after we come back from the break, because.
Yeah.
It just feels, because like this is Tuesday, and I'm like, I'm not doing what I should be doing on a Tuesday. So it's better
for
all.
It's a weird feeling. Yeah, it's like you're kind of like, you know, like, because Tuesday's my day off, so it's kind of like, it's not that I always enjoy doing the show, but it's kind of like, you know, your day is geared towards, you know, bringing the show. And It's not easy bringing, you know, topics and questions and how you're going to make this exciting and da-da-da-da.
Talking with each other, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's like to do it, you know, every Tuesday. And then all of a sudden you have off and you're thinking all this time, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm going
to
have 2 weeks of freedom.
You don't know what to do.
But then when you're in those 2 weeks, you're kind of like, oh, man, I really miss
Aww.
Makes So it's like you have this such excitement, you know, when you come back on that first show in January.
And I love the reactions that we get, because we always get one or two people who posted, like, the pick of the week that goes, wait a minute, where are you guys? So it's always like that thing, which is always, I enjoy that stuff. So it's cool, but, you know, Jesus Christ, yeah. 3 freaking years?
Yeah.
The Morelli Python Radio can almost go to kindergarten now. Do you realize that?
I know. That's pretty cool. But, I figured next week the show we'd leave it open because there's some topics that I want to hit on. I've kind of refrained from comment. You know, we have that whole thing with the I don't know if you're following it, Owen, but
the PJ.
Whole thing, I kind of want to – what I've learned in my life is that, you know, there's always, like, a bunch of sides to a story. So before you go guns a-blazing and sound like a freaking idiot, you know, get kind of hear some different perspectives and then make your judgment. So I figure that could be something that we'll hit on next week.
I figure by then we'll have a better understanding of what exactly is going on with that because I followed it for a little bit, but I haven't really gone – too deep into what's going on over there. But.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, but we'll leave that for.
Let's not give away the whole show. Yeah, we'll do that later.
Yeah.
So.
As far as myself, I have ebmorelia.com. I have babies that are almost ready.
Oh my God.
Yeah. they've eaten three, four meals, and it's pretty much ready to go. So if you're in looking for some albino stuff, and these are albino crosses, but, you know, like caramel jags or zebras or anything like that, I'm your guy. So I'm going to have some of that coming up available. The good thing is that if you're looking to get something like that and you'll be at Tinley Park, you can always, hook it up to pick up at Tinley Park. So we will be out there. Morelia Python Radio, E.B. Morelia, and Rogue Reptiles will all be representing in October.
One booth.
That's right. You don't need anything else. except maybe... if you're interested in some Borneo or blood pythons, you might want to check out
Matt.
The mats. Matt,
you had a baby today.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, baby girl. Congratulations to Matt.
Huh.
So,
congratulations, Matt. Wow, that's awesome.
Clearly, I'm more plugged into the news than you are. But
tell me these things.
She's supposed to be a co-host. Oh, is that what I'm supposed to do? Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, almost 3 years. I bet it'll figure it out eventually. But,
yeah.
So, Tinley Park is definitely going to be fun. But continue, sir.
Yeah. Congratulations, Matt. So, yeah, if you're interested in any of that or et cetera, you can check out, of course, our website, ebmorelia.com. If you have any questions for me personally relating to that, you can contact me at eric@ebmorelia.com. Check out our Facebook page, which is ebmorelia.com. We're also on Twitter, and we're also on Instagram. You know, I don't know why I say we're, because it's just me. You know what I mean? So I guess...
It's the royal we. Like, you know, you're assuming there's, you know, more of you or something like that, and now whenever you get picked off, you're just going to be like, we are not amused. That thing.
Yeah.
You do that funny wave in the car. It's kind of weird, but, you know.
I was thinking about that. Like, why do I keep saying we? There's only one person. There's me. So, I don't know. I'm going to keep going with we. And that's
just do it.
So, go ahead, Owen. Take us out.
Okay. What we got is rogue-reptiles.com. Also, you can find Rogue Reptiles on Facebook. We have a lot of babies that are coming up into availability. We have caramels, caramel jags, super caramel jags, We also have Caramels from last year. We have a bunch of Tigers coming up ready, and the Brettles just started their feed trials. Also, if you want to put on the list for Dominican Red Mountain Boas, we're going to start getting that together because I'm going to start getting them feeding, and then they're going to get the hell out of here. So if you want to get on any of the lists that we have of any of the animals, give us a call. We'll put you on the list. We'll get you started. The next show we have coming up is September 27th at Oaks, Pennsylvania. And then after that, we have nothing but Tinley Park. And, of course, right after Tinley is Hamburg. So
nice.
Rapid-fire shows in the next couple months. So if you want something and I have it, do not hesitate. Otherwise, it most likely will be gone by the time you come back around. With that, what we will say is good night, and we will catch everybody next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of Pro Exotics. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I created the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you the most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is, it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you got to check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying or selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rate. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship your reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit thereptilereport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit shipreptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile related.